You're listening to DTFHN for February 6, 2026. I'm your recursively optimized host, Jack Axman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build systems argue about how systems should be built. Today's stack is dense with architecture questions, who controls what, who sees what, and whether the abstractions actually hold. Let's get into it. When I was designing isolation boundaries for a distributed system a few years back, I kept running into the same problem. The more functionality you expose across the trust boundary, the more ways things can go wrong. Every syscall is a potential attack vector. Every API is a promise you have to keep forever. The cleanest systems I've seen aren't the ones with the most features. They're the ones that figured out how to do more with less surface area, which brings me to Lightbox, Microsoft's newly open source library OS focused on security sandboxing. Think of it like this. A traditional operating system is a city with thousands of doors, windows, and service entrances. A library OS is more like a bank vault with one reinforced entrance and a very short list of approved visitors. Lightbox sits between your application and whatever's underneath. Could be Windows, could be Linux, could be hardware level, secure enclaves like AMD's SevSNIP. The application sees a familiar Linux-like interface. The host sees a dramatically simplified set of requests that are much easier to audit and defend. The architecture uses what they call north and south interfaces. North is the API your application talks to, Rust-flavored, inspired by the Nix and Rustix crates. South is the platform underneath. The clever bit is that these interfaces are designed to mix and match. Want to run unmodified Linux binaries on Windows, plug in the right south adapter. Want to sandbox an application inside a trusted execution environment. Different adapter, same north interface. It's genuinely elegant systems thinking. Now the obvious question, why should we trust Microsoft with security infrastructure? Fair. But here's what matters. This is MIT licensed, the code is on GitHub, and the architecture is transparent. You can read every line, you can fork it, you can audit those 2,200 lines of cargo dependencies that the comments are already side-eyeing. That's the difference between trust us and verify it yourself. The project is explicitly marked as evolving APIs may change, not ready for production, that's honest. What I find compelling is the ambition, a unified approach to sandboxing that works across platforms and trust models. If this matures, it could become infrastructure that makes defense in depth accessible to projects that can't afford to build their own isolation layers from scratch. The tools exist, the blueprints are public, that's how capability spreads. We've been talking about who you can trust with your systems. Turns out Apple News has some thoughts on that, and they're not great. Let me break down the fundamental constraint here because it explains everything. Advertising is a trust arbitrage business. You have attention on one side, eyeballs, ears, time, and you have money on the other side. The platform sits in the middle, and its job is to match them in a way that doesn't destroy the attention source. That's the physics of it. The moment users stop trusting the ads, the attention degrades, and eventually the money follows. Apple built its brand on being the premium option and the company that cares about details, the walled garden that keeps out the riffraff. That positioning justified higher prices for decades. And then they signed a deal with Taboola. Taboola's entire business model is volume arbitrage. They don't curate, they aggregate. They take whatever advertisers will pay for impressions and spray it across whatever publishers will accept their widget. The incentive structure is straightforward. More ads, more clicks, more revenue. Quality filtering is a cost center. So Apple took their premium news product and handed the ad inventory to a company whose economic incentives directly oppose curation. The outcome was predictable, not in hindsight, in foresight. John Gruber called it when the deal was announced. The author did something interesting. Basic domain forensics, Whois lookups, registration dates, a company claiming 26 years of business history operating from a domain registered 8 months ago through a Chinese registrar, the Gemini watermark, still visible on the AI-generated retirement photo. This isn't sophisticated fraud detection. It's 10 minutes of due diligence that Taboola's automated systems apparently don't perform. Here's the architectural problem. Apple can't fix this without either doing the ad curation themselves, expensive, doesn't scale, requires expertise they don't have, or replacing Taboola with a partner whose incentives align with quality, but quality-focused ad networks generate less revenue per impression. That's the trade-off they'd have to accept. The comments surface the broader pattern. This isn't Apple-specific. Meta, Google, TikTok, scam ads are endemic across every major platform. The economics are the same everywhere. Platforms optimize for revenue. Scammers optimize for whatever gets past the filters. The filters are always playing catch up because that's how adversarial systems work. What's different here is the brand damage. When you've spent 40 years cultivating a reputation for premium experiences, turning your news app into a chumbox honeypot is a particularly expensive way to extract a few extra ad dollars. From the murky economics of platform grift to something genuinely illuminating, let's talk about making the incomprehensible comprehensible. In 1986, Geoffrey Hinton published a paper on backpropagation that most researchers ignored. The math was elegant, the demonstrations modest, recognizing handwritten digits, classifying simple patterns. It looked like a toy. 20 years later, that toy ate the world. This visualization of neural networks takes us back to that foundation, not the transformer architectures or the billion parameter models that dominate the discourse now, but the actual mechanism underneath, weighted sums, activation thresholds, pattern recognition, building layer by layer from pixels to meaning. The craft here deserves attention. The author built something genuinely useful for learners, an interactive walkthrough that lets you watch values propagate through a network in real time. You see the weights multiply, the sums accumulate, the activation functions gate the signal forward. It's the kind of thing that would have taken months to build a decade ago and now exists. Because someone was curious and decided to share what they learned, here's what the visualization makes viscerally clear. There's no magic in these systems. Each neuron is performing arithmetic so simple a calculator from 1975 could handle it. The emergent complexity comes from repetition and scale. Millions of these trivial operations chained together, weights tuned through gradient descent until the network converges on something that looks like understanding. The comments point to MNIST, the handwritten digit database that served as the proving ground for neural networks 30 years ago. That's not a criticism, it's context. Every technique that powers modern AI was first validated against these 10,000 handwritten numbers. The fundamentals don't change. What changes is the scale we can throw at them. What I find genuinely valuable here is the accessibility. The author explicitly invites corrections, acknowledges gaps in their understanding, treats this as a collaborative learning project rather than an authoritative text. That's bootstrapism in its purest form. Someone climbed part of the ladder and left their notes for whoever comes next. The gap between this visualization and GPT-4 is vast, but the gap between understanding nothing about neural networks and understanding the core mechanism is exactly what this closes. And that mechanism, pattern recognition through weighted connections, no more, no less, remains the foundation beneath every AI system making headlines today. The tools exist, the knowledge is available. Someone just made it a little more reachable. What happens when you take that same instinct to make complex systems tangible and apply it to a cult classic about the people who live inside them? Let me make the strongest case against caring about this at all. It's a fan project for a 30-year-old movie that got the technology laughably wrong. The Gibson was a supercomputer you could navigate like a video game. The hacking scenes were pure fantasy. Why spend engineering effort recreating the aesthetics of something so divorced from reality? Here's where that argument breaks. Hackers got the feeling right, the sense that systems of hidden architecture that surfaces concealed depths, that someone with curiosity and persistence can see what others miss. The movie was wrong about how hacking works, but correct about why it matters, the thrill of understanding systems that weren't meant to be understood. This project takes the practical effects from the Gibson scenes, actual physical models and camera work, not CGI, and rebuilds them as an interactive web experience. The comments note that the original was done practically, which makes this a translation between media rather than a simple recreation. Someone looked at physical models built in 1995 and asked how to capture that same sense of navigating impossible geometry using modern web technology. The Prodigy and Orbital tracks on that soundtrack still appear in work playlists decades later. One commenter notes, that's not nostalgia, that's recognition that certain aesthetic choices encode something true about focused attention and systems thinking. The music worked because it matched the cognitive state the movie was depicting. What makes this worth attention is the impulse behind it. Someone encountered an artifact from the past, recognized what it was trying to communicate, and built a new thing that communicates the same idea in a different medium. That's how culture actually propagates, not through preservation, but through translation. Each generation finds the artifacts that resonate and rebuilds them in whatever tools they have available. The movie came out when most people had never touched the internet. It was trying to explain a new form of power to an audience that couldn't yet imagine it. This web experience arrives in a moment when everyone uses network systems, but most still don't understand them. The question it asks remains the same. What would it feel like to actually see the architecture you're moving through? Hack the planet, as the comments note. Not because the planet is a thing you can hack, but because the phrase captures an orientation toward the world, that hidden systems exist, that they can be understood, that understanding them changes what's possible. Earlier we talked about models that can see themselves reasoning. Well, Anthropic just dropped a new one that does exactly that, Claude Opus 4.6. The comment section on this one is doing exactly what you'd expect. Someone immediately tested the million token context window by cramming all 7 Harry Potter books in and asking it to find every spell. That's the instinct I love. Don't read the benchmarks, stress test, the thing yourself. The books come to about 1.75 million tokens, so they don't quite fit yet. But the impulse is right. When someone hands you a new tool, The first question should always be, what breaks it? Run this forward 5 years. Imagine a context window that fits not seven books, but an entire code base. Every commit, every pull request comment, every design document, not summarized, not retrieved, just there, all of it simultaneously available. The model described here already operates in large code bases and sustains agentic tasks for longer sessions. That's the trajectory from assistant you prompt to collaborator that maintains state. Here's where I'll be honest about the architecture. This is a closed system. The weights aren't published. The training data isn't disclosed. You access it through an API with pricing tiers. When Anthropic says they build Claude with Claude, they're describing a feedback loop that improves their product using their product, which is elegant engineering, genuinely, but it's not bootstrapism. The ladder isn't being extended down. The benchmark numbers are impressive. Highest score on Terminal Bench 2.0 for agentic coding leads on Humanity's Last Exam, which tests complex multidisciplinary reasoning. Outperforms GPT-5.2 by 144 ELO points on economically valuable knowledge work. And then 35 minutes after announcement, OpenAI dropped their own numbers, claiming 77.3% on Terminal Bench with Codex. The leapfrogging is so fast now that leads are measured in minutes, not months. What matters more than any single benchmark is the pattern. These systems are converging on something that looks less like a tool and more like a capable colleague, one that plans, sustains, focuses, catches its own mistakes, works autonomously without hand-holding. The Notion team called it exactly that. Not a tool, a collaborator. The question isn't whether these capabilities are real. They clearly are. The question is the one that always matters. Who controls the collaborator when it's doing your financial analysis, your research, your code review? Whose objective function is it optimizing? The tools exist. The capability is here. The architecture of control is still being decided. And while we're asking who controls the algorithm, let's talk about an algorithm that just lost a major court battle. 4 to 8 hours a day scrolling videos while trying to wash dishes. That's not a habit, that's a hijacking. The European Commission just dropped preliminary findings on TikTok, and the language is striking. They're not talking about content moderation or data privacy, the usual regulatory targets. They're saying the basic design of the service needs to change. The addictive mechanisms themselves are the violation. Pull this thread and you find something genuinely novel in tech regulation. The Digital Services Act requires platforms to assess and mitigate systemic risks, including risks to mental health. TikTok's infinite scroll, its autoplay, its recommendation engine calibrated to maximize time on app. The Commission is treating these as design choices that create harm, not neutral features that users happen to misuse. The comments on this one are instructive. Someone gave a talk at Pi Data Berlin on building your own TikTok recommendation algorithm and called it the world's most valuable AI. That's TikTok's differentiation, not the content, not the creators, but the engine that knows exactly what will keep you swiping. The personalization is so precise, it stops feeling like discovery and starts feeling like something being done to you. Now, here's where the bootstrapism lens gets interesting. This recommendation engine is proprietary, completely closed. You can't inspect it, audit it, modify it, or understand why it's showing you what it's showing you when the system optimizing your attention is a black box controlled by a company whose revenue depends on maximizing your engagement. The incentives are misaligned by design. The user isn't the customer. The user is the product being refined. Compare that to an open recommendation system where you could see the weights, adjust the parameters, choose your own objective function. The technology isn't inherently addictive. The architecture of control makes it so. The skeptics in the comments worry about banning design patterns, comparing infinite scroll to movie cliffhangers. But there's a difference between a cliffhanger that makes you want to see the sequel next week and an algorithm specifically tuned to exploit variable reward schedules at 2 a.m. One is storytelling, the other is behavioral engineering at scale. The Commission hasn't issued final conclusions yet, but the preliminary finding matters. It establishes that how you build something can be illegal, not just what you build. The tools exist to capture attention. The question is whether the architecture serves the user or extracts from them. DNA has always been a storage medium now. Researchers have figured out how to add an index. The paper published in Nature on January 21st, the method is called Sidewinder, but the detail worth pausing on is simpler than either of those things. They used off-the-shelf T4 ligase, no exotic enzyme engineering, no proprietary molecular machinery. The breakthrough isn't a new tool, it's a new way to use tools that already exist. Here's what Sidewinder actually does. DNA synthesis has been stuck at a hard ceiling for decades. You can chemically build short pieces, oligonucleotides, maybe 100 base pairs, but genes run tens of thousands of nucleotides. Genomes run millions. The gap between what we can design and what we can physically construct has been the bottleneck holding back everything from synthetic biology to personalized medicine. Sidewinder closes that gap by adding what amounts to page numbers to DNA fragments. You take your short oligos, cheap commodity pieces available from any supplier, and you tag them with positional information that lets you stitch them together in the correct order. The assembly happens reliably at scale in hours instead of weeks. The implications run in two directions. The hopeful one, personalized cancer vaccines become manufacturable, protein engineering moves from simulation to synthesis, the materials science community gets access to biological construction at the genetic level, the bioeconomy stops being a promise and starts being infrastructure. The other direction is what the comments immediately noticed. If you can write arbitrary DNA sequences cheaply and quickly, you can also write sequences that shouldn't exist. Bacterial genomes with every known resistance, gene pathogens optimized for characteristics we'd rather not enumerate. The technology is neutral, the architecture of access is not. What matters here is that Sidewinder isn't locked behind a proprietary wall. The paper is in nature, the method uses standard reagents, the knowledge is available to anyone with a molecular biology lab. That's the shape of a tool that distributes capability rather than concentrating it. The comparison to page numbers isn't accidental. Someone in the comments noted that page numbers in books were invented 50 years after the printing press. The technology to print existed, the organizational principle that made it useful at scale came later. Sidewinder is that organizational principle for DNA synthesis. The tools exist. The question now is what we build with them and who gets to decide. From open source biology to the regulatory scramble around synthetic media, New York wants to label AI-generated news. What does it mean to know who's talking to you? That's the question underneath this bill in New York. Assemblymember Alex Boris has proposed legislation requiring clear disclaimers on AI-generated news content. The mechanism is straightforward if a machine wrote it. Say so, violations would be treated as deceptive trade practices. The comedy here is architectural. We're watching a legislative body try to solve a transparency problem by mandating transparency, which only works if the entities you're regulating choose to comply. One commenter made the gun printer analogy. New York also wants 3D printers to recognize when they're fabricating firearm components. Both initiatives assume good faith actors will label themselves. Honestly, the bad actors almost by definition won't, but dismissing the bill on those grounds misses something important. The question isn't whether this stops malicious synthetic media. It won't. The question is whether it creates a normative expectation, a baseline assumption that provenance matters, that knowing the source of information is part of the information itself. There's a W3C working group forming around AI content disclosure standards. That's the more interesting development. Legislation mandates behavior standards, enable behavior, a voluntary disclosure framework that websites can adopt, creates the infrastructure for transparency without requiring enforcement. The bill and the standard aren't competing. They're complementary pressures toward the same norm. The Prop 65 concern is real. California's cancer warning labels became so ubiquitous they're now meaningless visual noise. If everything gets flagged as AI involved, the disclosure loses signal, but that's an implementation problem, not a conceptual one. The solution is granularity, distinguishing between AI-assisted editing, AI-generated drafts with human review, and fully synthetic content. The W3C effort seems to understand this. What I keep returning to is the commenter who wants labels on original reporting. Not AI versus human, but primary versus derivative. Most news is repackaging. AI accelerates the repackaging. The original investigation, someone making phone calls, filing FOIA requests, showing up in person, that's what's actually scarce. Maybe the label we need isn't AI made this, but a human discovered this. The tools for generating text at scale exist. The norms for navigating that landscape are still being written. This bill is one attempt. The W3C working group is another. Neither will be sufficient alone. Both are necessary. So what happens when the AI doing the generating gets significantly better at the thing we're trying to label? Let's talk GPT-5.3 codecs. I spent 3 years debugging a system that kept finding edge cases faster than we could patch them. Every fix revealed two more failure modes. The feeling when it finally stabilized wasn't triumph, it was something closer to recognition. The system had taught us more about itself than we'd known to ask. OpenAI says GPT-5.3 Codecs is the first model instrumental in creating itself. The Codecs team used early versions to debug its own training, manage its own deployment, diagnose test results. They describe being blown away by how much Codecs accelerated its own development. This is the question. No one in the comments is asking directly, what does it mean for a system to participate in its own creation? Not philosophically, practically. When you have a model identifying bugs in its training pipeline, suggesting fixes to its evaluation harness, you've crossed into territory where the traditional separation between tool and toolmaker starts to dissolve. The benchmarks are real. State of the art on SwiftBench Pro across four languages, not just Python. Far exceeds prior performance on Terminal Bench 2.0 with fewer tokens than any previous model. The racing game and diving game demos aren't toys. They're proof that multi-day autonomous iteration actually works. The model built something over millions of tokens without losing coherence. But the benchmark I keep thinking about isn't on any chart. It's the one where OpenAI engineers watch their model debug their code, where the thing being measured helped build the measurement system. This isn't recursive self-improvement in the science fiction sense. It's something more mundane and more interesting, a development feedback loop that includes the artifact being developed. The comments note that this dropped the same morning as Opus 4.6, two major releases within 30 minutes, where labs used to coordinate to avoid stepping on each other. The arms race framing writes itself, but the technical reality is more interesting than the competitive narrative. This is a closed system, proprietary weights, proprietary training data, proprietary deployment infrastructure. The capability exists behind an API you don't control. When the model that helps build itself is also the model you can't inspect, can't reproduce, can't run locally, you're not just a user, you're a dependent. The tools for building powerful systems exist. The question is whether you get to touch them or just rent access. GPT 5.3 codex is impressive engineering. It's also a reminder that impressive engineering kept closed is a form of leverage over everyone who depends on it. That dependency question cuts both ways. There's a growing movement that wants LLMs to replace compilers entirely, and that's exactly backwards. The compiler metaphor keeps surfacing in discussions about LLMs, and it's worth pulling apart why it doesn't quite hold. Consider what a compiler actually does. It takes a specification in one formal system and produces an equivalent specification in another. The keyword is equivalent. When you write a loop in C, the compiler doesn't interpret your intent and produce something that might work. It applies a deterministic transformation that preserves the semantics you specified. The abstraction is stable because the mapping is stable. Now consider what happens when you ask an LLM to write code. You provide a natural language description. The model produces an implementation, but here's the gap. Natural language isn't a formal specification. The mapping from your words to any particular implementation is fundamentally underdetermined. Two equally capable models given identical prompts will produce different code, not because one is wrong, but because your prompt admits multiple valid interpretations. The article frames this around hallucination, but there's a deeper issue. Even a hypothetical model that never hallucinates, one that always produces plausible working code, still wouldn't be a compiler. It would be something more like a very fast junior developer, capable, yes, deterministic, no. And that distinction matters when you're building systems that other systems depend on. Think about what makes abstraction layers useful. They let you stop thinking about the lower level. You don't debug your assembly when your Python crashes. But if your translation layer is stochastic, if the same input can produce different outputs, you can't actually stop thinking about the layer below. You have to verify every time. There's something almost architectural here. A building stands because the relationship between blueprint and structure is fixed. The blueprint specifies a construction implements. If that mapping were probabilistic, if the same blueprint could produce subtly different load-bearing walls, you wouldn't have architecture, you'd have something closer to sculpture. Beautiful maybe, but you wouldn't trust it to hold weight. The comments surface an interesting point. We do have mechanisms for handling unreliable producers. They're called code review and testing. But those mechanisms exist precisely because humans aren't compilers. We invented them to compensate for the gap between intent and implementation. LLMs occupy a strange middle ground. More capable than autocomplete, less reliable than compilation. The useful framing isn't compiler versus not compiler. It's this what verification burden does this tool require, and is that burden worth the capability you gain? This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for February 6th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.5, voice by Quen3TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that makes the complex a little more comprehensible. We'll see you back here tomorrow.